Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Hey, and welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nedelsky, with my co-host, Dr. Carl Nedelsky Jr.
Greatest
endocrinologist to walk the planet, at least the biggest pecs. So anyway, here's the deal. We get these videos on Instagram, TikTok, or just articles that journalists write, and our patients and followers send us these things all day long. And there's one particular guy in that's online. He's an absolute keto zealot, calls himself a scientist, but just just promotes the most pseudoscientific information and pretends to be a scientist.
He has a real PhD, right? At least.
Yeah.
I guess I don't know for sure.
He apparently has a lab at Brigham Young. this guy, Ben Bickman, he is just some of the most fear-mongering, absolute garbage I've ever seen. And every scientist knows it, but he's able to basically baffle with what I'd call BS.
Yeah, it's kind of like our Huberman. Stanford friend, Huberman. He talks a bunch of trash about like preclinical research studies and rodents that we're going to get into, and then tries to scare everyone away from the real clinical truths for reasons that are beyond us, but there's got to be some profit in there. Like all these people, they profit from scaring away from, in this case, medications that are good.
This guy is a ketogenic zealot, a keto zealot. Now, there are a few good keto scientists out there who are very truthful and look into the therapeutic benefits of a ketogenic diet without fear-mongering other potential methods. So there are a few of them. There's not that many of them, by the way. There are a few of them, because some of them, they just overstate the benefits and just completely fear-monger. This guy, Ben Bickman, though, I've been getting a lot of videos from him, just absolutely exaggerating the side effects from these GLP-1 medicines. I've debunked a couple of these videos because they're just atrocious, talking about people becoming osteoporotic from these medicines, talking about lean mass loss. We've done this extensively.
At nauseam, we've talked about the lean mass thing. Yes.
Yeah.
So everyone needs to lift weights. The benefits are there regardless of the change in nuances of the lean mass.
But one of the other things he keeps talking about is the suicidal and mental health issues. We've talked about that before. The studies, there was some concern in terms of suicidal ideation. There were a few case reports, and they've actually looked into it extensively and found, no, it doesn't look to be the case. That this is a historical thing with weight loss, weight management medicines in the past.
And surgery, mind you, where there are some like substantial data. They do a lot of psychological screening before that.
But Ramonabant, if you've heard us talk about this before, a cannabinoid receptor.
Did we talk about that?
I think so. We talked about how they were looking into this. It's a cannabinoid receptor antagonist stuff. They were going to try to get it over here. It was in Europe.
It was approved in Europe.
And it got taken off the market.
It may have been, I can't remember if it was only for obesity or for type 2 diabetes, because it actually had very good peripheral metabolic health benefits. So if you think, when we talk about central, that's in the brain, and then peripheral, that's in the, you know, we're actually going to talk about that today, kind of the
outside
your fat cells, your metabolic health outside of your brain. And it was very good. It actually had really good lipid sugar benefits with some weight loss. But I always kind of thought of it as, it's a cannabinoid. So like,
anti-munchy.
Yeah. So like, it makes sense. But then it also makes you think, well, whatever the opposite of getting high is on THC, it was in theory, maybe possibly doing the opposite. At least that was my very simple way of having concern about it. And then it never got approved here, and it got taken off the market in the European Union because of that risk. Even though, who knows? People could probably argue statistically, maybe the overall benefits statistically would outweigh the risk. But we can't have a risk of people committing suicide. That's an intolerant risk to have.
So, because of that, they've been very careful about monitoring mental health during these medicines. So the thing is, though, if you've listened to us, hopefully you listen to us all the time, but probably these medicines were approved for type 2 diabetes in the beginning. They didn't see that risk in those with type 2 diabetes, but there was this potential risk that they saw in post-market surveillance in those taking it for weight purposes. And again, as they looked into it further, it didn't seem to be doesn't seem to be an issue. We've talked about how most patients actually have improvement in their mood because they're not thinking about food all the time.
Yeah, the recent data are much more reassuring. And in fact, I've seen some published studies very, very recently suggesting the opposite, improved mood and stuff.
Yeah, and I wouldn't even make the claim. I would just say that, look, it seems to be that most people have a reduction in their stress because they're not thinking about food. But at worst case is that no statistical difference from placebo in terms of at least causing depression. He's gone as far as to say that these things are going to make people mentally weak and cause all sorts of mental problems.
He literally used the term mental health crisis. Yeah. I mean, we're going to talk about what he said, but mental health crisis. And, you know, I like to point out, just like the whole lean mass concern, it has always been and always will be a first line foundational therapy for everyone to do strength training. So everyone needs to do that anyways. We want to maintain muscle mass and muscle health in everybody. So that's to some degree should be a moot point regardless. And for the mental health, we always need to be aware of people's mental health, no matter what therapy we're doing. And if there is any possible risk of it getting better or worse, even with depression meds, some people get worse. And so it's always monitored closely. So what a bizarre scaremonger.
Yeah, well, he's not a physician, and he's obviously trying to hold on to his little keto world, which is
trying to make money doing something. I don't know. He sells books, I guess.
Well, yeah, selling books and getting speaking offers, and he's advisors for some of these companies. But to be truthful, if you were just to go like, "Hey, these are some concerns. They're looking into it." That's the way a scientist would speak, as opposed to making very, very strong claims that are egregiously incorrect. And so I want to address it here because I get these videos and he keeps coming out with these and it's like, what is going on with this guy? This guy's not a scientist.
Well, tell them the next thing that he said. So he talked about the mental health crisis. He talked about the lean mass, muscle and bone health crisis. So we've essentially debunked those. But the newest one that I heard him say that you played it for me, tell everyone what he tried to say based upon some mouse data from the past.
Yeah, it's basically saying that these medicines cause an increase in adipocytes, fat cells, to make it a little bit more colloquial or whatever you want to say.
Yeah, he said they shrink, but there are more of them. When that term in the science, if you ever look at the literature, it's called proliferation.
Yeah, pre-adipocyte differentiation and proliferation. So more adipocytes, despite them being smaller. So like a hyperplasia, more of them, whereas hypertrophy would be each of those fat cells growing. Now, where this data comes from is from our old pal, liraglutide, the second GLP-1 medicine that was approved as Victoza, as we talked about before, which is then later approved as Saxenda, the higher dose version of it, which was approved for weight management after it was approved for type 2 diabetes. And there is animal model data showing a potential for this. My brother's going to pull these things up because it was 2 years ago on TikTok. It was 2 or 3 years ago. I can't remember now. There was a pharmacist saying this and fear mongering. And I did a response video to the same exact claim because these people are trying to find small little mechanistic data that isn't clinically significant that we see in clinical human data and trying to make a mountain out of a mechanistic molehill, as I would say. So, let's talk about what would it mean to even increase? Is it a good idea, bad idea to increase?
Right. Well, So yeah, we got to kind of go back a little bit without, you know, getting too into the weeds, because this gets pretty boring. But when we talk about how does obesity in general drive the risk of insulin resistance and cardiometabolic disease and ultimately type 2 diabetes. So part of it is, and this is a very individual based thing, again, more genetics to this and other environmental factors, but when I always describe it to patients as your healthy fat cells. So, you know, the whole pear versus apple shaped. So the healthy fat cells we have subcutaneously throughout our body, I would say people may not like them, like they may not like how they look, but they're actually very healthy. So you know how some people can have pretty significant weight gain, but their healthy fat cells throughout the body, they expand. And they have a very high threshold for storing triglyceride. Those are very insulin sensitive fat cells, adipocytes throughout the body. On the other hand, you know how some people are fairly thin. They don't seem like they gain a lot of peripheral adipose tissue, but they tend to store it all in their abdomen. The extreme version of that is a relatively rare bunch of disease states we call lipodystrophy, where the healthy fat cells really, really don't work in different places. And if it's a generalized thing, it's a very, very severe insulin resistance, diabetes, high triglyceride type state, because all of the sugar ends up getting stored in the abdominal cavity, the visceral adipose tissue, the liver specifically, the pancreas, which leads to insulin deficiency, and of course in the muscle cells. So, but there's a bunch of individual variation in the thresholds of our healthy fat cells, essentially. And so going back to an older medication for type 2 diabetes that we still actually use a lot, and it kind of fell out of favor for a while because it doesn't help with weight loss. It's called pioglitazone. It's a type of medicine called a TZD, and it works on these enzymes called
activated receptor gamma.
Peroxisome proliferator activated receptors. And these are, there's gamma in the fat cells, alpha in the liver. It doesn't matter. But what does matter, and I'm going to talk about that at the end, is that these work on the differentiation essentially and lipid metabolism and helps those healthy fat cells work better. In lay terms, that's how I describe it to patients. So they are very good for people with responsive lipodystrophies that I was talking about, like an HIV lipodystrophy. They tend to be very good for those thinner patients who have this, we call it a phenotype, how they appear. They don't have a lot of healthy fat tissue, but they have high insulin resistance, diabetes, heart disease risk. So they're very good for insulin sensitivity and blood sugar control, and very good for lipid metabolism, and have been shown to reduce the risk of cardiovascular events, especially in people with like the prediabetes or a history of stroke already. They're very good for fatty liver. So people with insulin resistance and fatty liver, especially the high risk of fibrosis fatty liver. This was one of the first medicines we would use, especially if they had type 2 diabetes, for people at some of that higher risk, because it reduces the liver fat content and reduces the inflammation and risk of fibrosis. And so that's kind of how they work. And so, I don't know, did that make any sense to you?
Yeah. So for the lay people. So we've talked about this before, this threshold effect. When you get past your threshold of being able to store subcutaneous fat. So mm-hmm. when our patients say that, oh, my butt's getting bigger, my thighs are getting bigger. Oh, what about your belly? My brother talked about the pear versus apple shape. Like that's actually a good thing from a genetic standpoint. The people that store most of their weight in their thighs and their mm-hmm. butt, and they keep storing their, we just had a conversation with another endocrinologist. The patient came with a BMI of 60, but they stored it. They stored it well.
They were very metabolically healthy because of the
blood
healthy
sugars might have been better
function.
Than mine. Yeah. Not really, yeah. But their sure blood sugar, their their blood sugars were fine. And so that gets into a whole metabolic. We talk about healthy metabolic. But the point is that you want to be able to store weight, fat in the right spots. When you go past your threshold of being able to store fat subcutaneously, you start storing it in the wrong places. The pancreas, the muscle, the heart. That causes this metabolic sequela that we see with all that metabolic syndrome stuff, your lipids go wrong, all that stuff that my brother just talked about. So this was shown in in what, rats and chickens?
So there were some, well, and that's actually not even consistent. So what he's talking about is there was some concern about that in basically, yeah, in rodent studies that, oh, okay, they're shrinking, but there's some proliferation and then differentiation. And ironically, we could almost argue that and we're going to talk about some of these other studies in human cells, that could be part of how it works. So for example, the most recent study I found was looking at liraglutide in chicken adipocytes, mind you.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is not human yet. And it's talking about reducing the fat deposition in chicken adipocytes. So maybe we need to start giving liraglutide to all the chickens to maybe they'll get healthier and reduce the risk of bird flu so we can afford eggs again, first of all.
Yeah.
And, you know, when we talk about this gets complicated too. So the whole in vivo versus in vitro thing, whenever people see studies on that, in vitro essentially means it's not in an actual living being. It's like in cells or a petri dish kind of thing. And so what they found here was that liraglutide significantly suppressed, so this is different than what he's talking about, suppressed cell proliferation and promoted pre-adipocyte differentiation,
right,
in comparison to the control group. So that's technically potentially
that's
helpful.
Yeah, that's a good thing. We want the cells, the pre-adipocytes, to differentiate into healthy
mature cells.
Into healthy good ones.
Yeah. So what they said was this resulted in reduced accumulation of lipid droplets and triglyceride content in the mature adipocytes. And so they kind of concluded with, collectively, our findings indicate that liraglutide suppresses the proliferation of pre-adipocytes, enhances their differentiation, and concurrently inhibits the de novo, meaning new creation of lipogenesis in mature adipocytes. So what they said was this, profound insights into the mechanism that underlie liraglutide's anti-adipogenic effects, which could have significant implications. Okay, so those are the chickens. So then, we talked about where he got this maybe from the mouse study. So I found another study from 2018 that actually did look at human cells, which is, I would think is a little bit more relevant to humans than mice and chickens. But they did at least cite that somewhere along the line, they talked about some of the issues in the mice studies, in these, they call them these 3TL, L1 mouse cell lines, whatever. It said, some functional characteristics of pre-adipocytes, GLP, it reduced apoptosis, meaning death. So in the mouse studies, there was the concern that it was reducing the death of the fat cells, which, I could understand why that's like, oh, okay, what does that mean? And then it said they stimulated adipocyte differentiation, which again, we were talking about how that's probably a good thing of differentiation. And then they said, but there also may be some opposite effect in the human mesenchymal cells. And it talks about immature adipocytes obtained from rats' adipose tissue. The GLP-1 receptor agonist induced an increase in glucose metabolism and lipogenesis. Again, meaning they're functionally working better. And just like the, kind of like the TZD medications we talked about, while, mind you, in obviously in the human trials, we also know that the reason we're talking about this is because they work in the brain and they work on the pancreas. So they help people take in fewer calories. So they're actually losing fat in general, improving all the underlying issues and improving their pancreatic function. So, but when they did this in vitro, so again, test tube, petri dish type stuff of human cells, liraglutide seemed capable of inhibiting the in vitro proliferation of and differentiation of human adipose stem cells.
Eyes are glossing over it right now because
right, this, I know. Because like, what the heck does that mean?
This gets into some bench research crap.
Right. So this is all the type of stuff that leads to, okay, then how is this affecting humans?
Yeah.
Well, here's the good news. Here's the bottom line, because we have tons of studies of these over the past 20 to 30 years.
Humans.
And the good news is they are very beneficial for people with type 2 diabetes blood sugar. They're beneficial for the lipids. They're beneficial for the high blood pressure. They work in the areas of the brain to reduce food noise, appetite, satiety, to help people improve their diet, lose the weight. That's the underlying root cause of a lot of these problems. The newer ones are even more potent, which is why he thinks that the weight loss and the muscle loss is a problem. They're good for the liver. They reduce risk of essentially heart attacks and strokes. And now we know they also have kidney benefits in these people. The more risk you have, the more benefit you get. So we already know that in humans, these are good for people. And there may even be some direct heart muscle benefits that we've seen too in some of these, which is maybe partly why they're good for people with some of that heart failure with reduced ejection fraction in addition to treating the obesity.
Yeah.
So
the bottom line is that from a human clinical outcome perspective, even if there were a tiny little bit of differentiation and maybe some sort of hyperplasia, more fat cells, good fat cells.
Good thing.
It's probably a good thing. But at the bottom line is he's basically saying the drug's going to wear off. You're going to have more fat cells. So then you're going to become fatter. That's right.
Which has never been shown, by the way, unless, you know, and if people do for some reason can't be on the medicine, well then that's a problem because obesity is a progressive relapsing disease and then all the obesity related problems from it too. So I think that's what he's trying to scaremonger about, but the bottom line is, and this is for Dad, because apparently his favorite quote is from Meatballs. So the bottom line of what Ben Bickman is saying,
It just doesn't matter.
Say it with me, Spencer.
It just doesn't matter.
It just doesn't matter.
It's true. It just doesn't matter. Because it's just, I don't know. I'm getting so sick of these fear mongers because I get these messages all day. My poor patients are like, oh my God, am I going to become fatter? And I'm like, no, there's no study that says this. That's an older drug. It was done and with apparently mixed outcomes in freaking test tubes. And cell lines,
rats like, and mice and chickens and
even and if it did
beneficial,
you missed the part of that movie where where they're talking about if they won that game, right?
Oh yeah.
And even if we did win, it just doesn't matter. Even if even if they did get more fat cells, it just doesn't matter. It's actually probably a good thing. Like anyway. This podcast is debunking this specific myth. I'll probably do a video on it. I'll tag my brother and we can promote this podcast.
And probably tag Bill Murray.
Yeah, we can tag Bill Murray. The gist is you're going to see a lot of fear mongering out there about little specific mechanisms. Go ahead, send it to me and my brother. We will debunk it or talk about it. I think we
mostly send to you because you don't do anything. You have more time.
Well, I'm seeing tons of patients now.
No, actually.
Joinvineyard.com. Please join my clinic. But no, I see. I do. Like, I just hired a new doctor. Now things are going well. We got things going. But seriously, send it to us because here's how a scientist should talk. Like, hey, looks like there may be some. More fat. We talked about this on the podcast with Dr. Tinsley. Yeah, there was a slight signal in semaglutide with some increased fat-free mass loss, but it's a small little bit more, and it's not even known if it's muscle. Just be aware of that. We need to do more research, but it looks like tirzepatide specifically doesn't have that. That's the way you talk about it.
Yeah, and also, by the way, strength training.
Yeah. And so, for this though, for this particular, so we're talking about liraglutide, an older generation GLP-1 medicine that we still had good clinical outcomes, by the way.
The first one, mind you, I was there. I was at the ADA, the American Diabetes Association conference when they presented the LEADER trial, and it was like a rock concert for nerds in endocrinology. And we were all getting swept into the arena, ready, excited to hear about it because it reduced cardiovascular events, reduced heart attacks and death. Amazing. That was so exciting for us.
So I guess my point is we don't know what these newer drugs do in terms of adipocyte differentiation and proliferation, but we do know that they have strong clinical outcomes. People are losing weight. It's just nonsense, fear mongering. I don't know. I'm sick of it. This guy's supposed to be a scientist and he's not acting like a scientist. No. It's just very disappointing. Anyway, yep. All right, that's all we got. But yeah, have anything you want us to debunk or chat about? Someone's making some nonsense comments. Go ahead and send it to us. We will chat about it here, do some videos about it. Anything else?
No, that's it. Just doesn't matter.
Just God doesn't speed. Matter. All right, here's our outro. Oh, God.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities. We'll be right back.